Now more than ever, Lowe's knows you don't just want a low price, you want the lowest price. And with our lowest price guarantee, you can count on us for competitive prices on all your home improvement projects. If you find a qualifying lower price somewhere else on the same item, we'll match it. Lowe's, we help, you save. Price match applies to same item, current price at qualifying retailers. Exclusions and terms apply. Learn how we'll match price at lowes.com/lowest price guarantee.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail, companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop, and hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest of my podcast this week is Maximus Greenwald, CEO of Warmly.
In any business, revenue is oxygen, and you need oxygen to live and to succeed. And so as we were starting to make money and make money fast, we saw an excitement in the company and a devotion to work harder that we had never seen in our earlier six pivots. And so I think that's one of the most critical things is like just having momentum gets everyone excited to keep pushing along.
This is Maximus. After working at Google, he and his co-founders quit their jobs to start a company with what he calls the world's worst idea, Tinder for co-founders. What makes his journey fascinating is how he navigated through six pivots over 3 years, each time confronting the challenges of product market fit, customer alignment, and sustainable growth. Throughout this process, he grappled with the central question that many founders face: when to explore new ideas and when to commit fully to execution. And this inspired me, and hence I invited Max to my podcast. We explore the challenges of finding focus in startup chaos, the tension between vision and execution, and the counterintuitive reality that momentum often precedes perfection. Max's leadership principles cut through the typical startup fluff with refreshing directness, challenging conventional wisdom about when to sell, how to pivot, and what metrics truly matter for early stage companies. By listening to this podcast, you will learn four things. Firstly, the hidden pitfalls of pursuing product market fit over generating actual revenue. Secondly, why standard metrics often mislead early stage founders away from what truly matters. Thirdly, the real challenge of knowing when to stay the course versus when to pivot. And lastly, why some customers might be holding back your company's growth potential. Well, hi, Maximus. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
You're welcome. Super happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I mean, I see a whole range of people. This is, of course, an audio podcast, but if you ever see the video, there's a whole range of things that he's saying about himself. Chief Warmster at Warmly, amateur freestyle rapper, and recently got telemark skis. And for everybody's full transparency, he's not in the US. He's in Chamonix, France, because he likes skiing. But that's not what we're going to talk about today. That said, though, what drives you? What do you get energy from?
Oh, so many things. But I think really just the drive to learn. So one of our core values at Warmly is called slope over y-intercept. And it's kind of like a math joke. Like basically the slope of a line is the rate of change and the y-intercept is where you start. And so if somebody comes in and they start at zero, they don't know anything about their role or our space, but they learn really fast, over time, their rate of change is tremendous and they can learn super, super fast and they'll be smarter than anybody else. Whereas people who come in who may think they know a lot, but if they don't learn fast, then they're not going to grow a lot over time. And so something that gives me a lot of energy is increasing my slope of learning, which is basically consuming as much as I possibly can and learning as much as I possibly can to be successful. Because there's so many things I don't know about building a successful business that if I only knew, I'd be able to make this one more successful.
Well, I got something for you then. But I love your line there on the slope. I mean, connecting to the skiing part as well, and the learning. And how important is curiosity then for you as a person, but also within the business?
I mean, I think the obvious answer has to be yes. Yeah, I mean, rooting out problems is only possible through curiosity. I think unless you're asking questions all the time, you kind of can't surface problems. I think a lot of times people accept problems as reality. And so I'll have employees in the business who will do something one way over and over and over again. And they just sort of accepted that it can't be changed. And then when I take a look at it, I'm like, you know what? Like, is that as great as it could be? And so having that curiosity or curious mindset is, yeah, really important to be able to uncover those things. So yeah, I'd say curiosity is very important to business building.
Yeah, well, I mean, my question maybe should have been more crisp on, do you challenge people on it? Do you actually encourage them to build the muscle?
That's a great point. Honestly, I would say not as much as I should. You know, I've only been a manager now for 4 years, and I'm still learning how to help coach people to be more successful in their careers. I don't think I'm very good at it. Like, Wormley's, what, 60 people now? And I think I'm one of the worst managers at the company. And I have a lot to learn and grow to improve. And one of those definitely is encouraging curiosity from the people on my team. Something I've gotten okay at is encouraging people to define problems instead of bringing me solutions. Because I think a lot of the time you'll have someone, you know, a more junior employee will come forward and say, I want to change this email. And I'll say, whoa, take a step back. First, tell me, what's the problem you're solving? And when you reframe their mindset around, hey, I want to list the biggest problems I'm facing and then give you solutions for how to solve those, it really changes the types of actions they take. And so, yeah, I mean, maybe the email's not that important. Maybe there's a much bigger problem, bigger fish to fry, if you will, in the organization. So I would say that's like one way that I've helped coach employees of the company. But I have so much more to learn. And I think enabling and instilling curiosity is an important one.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, reason why I'm asking, I wrote this book, The Remarkable Effect, and trait number four of those software companies that become the ones we start talking about and keep talking about is that they master curiosity. And I've seen so much about Wormley, and I've actually been recommended to get you on the podcast by someone else, Aaron McReynolds from Alicio, who was an earlier guest. So yeah, let's bridge to the company then. You said you've been managing the business for 4 years. I think November 29, it was started, right? It was founded at Wormley.
Yeah, so the business has been around for 6 years, but I've only been a manager for four. So for the first couple of years, it was just the co-founders and I messing around trying to figure out what to do.
Yeah, okay, good. So talking about that, what was the big idea that got the business started? What was the problem that you saw that were screaming for a solution like Wormley?
We have the best idea in the world. So we were working at Google and we wanted to start a business, but the problem is we didn't know how to find co-founders. So the big idea was Tinder for co-founders. And so the first app we ever made was a swiping app where you would fill out a profile of how great of an entrepreneur you were, and we would match you to another co-founder to have a coffee chat to see if you could start a business. This was the world's worst idea on the planet. And we basically had to pivot six more times before we figured out how to actually build a real business over the course of 3 years. But that inspired us to quit our jobs and start Wormley.
Well, it has to start somewhere, right? And if you got the conviction that this is the problem you want to solve, find co-founders, then, well, at least you found co-founders and you got on the road and then you started figuring out what was wrong to get it right. Fun story, by the way. So, yeah, I'm intrigued by the six pivots, but we'll get to that later on. What has been an early decision that has sort of defined the success that you're seeing right now? Because now it's definitely going.
I think the early decision that has helped define our success is I think conviction to sell ahead of where we were. So I think we put our foot on the gas on go-to-market and go-to-market strategy before our product was really ready. And we're paying some prices for that now, right? Like we have 300 plus customers. They all have different needs. We haven't built out the full product yet. But I think that in any business, revenue is oxygen, and you need oxygen to live and to succeed. And so as we were starting to make money and make money fast, because we were sort of selling aggressively and putting, kind of a lot of effort in our go-to-market motion, and learning from the market, of course, which then fed back into product, which was good. But we saw a excitement in the company and a devotion to work harder that we had never seen in our earlier six pivots. And so I think that's one of the most critical things is like just having momentum gets everyone excited to keep pushing along. And like we used to host all these different team bonding and team culture events that brought us closer together as a team. And we still do those, but we used to do them out of fear that employees would leave our company. And now I wake up in the morning and I'd be pretty surprised if any employee wanted to leave warmly. Not because we're the best company in the world or because we're going to make the most money in the world or we have the best culture in the world, but we're growing and it's fun and it's exciting and everything's broken and it's just all sorts of good stuff to just sort of iterate on. And I think people can really help define their own careers by working at our company because they can say, I was there when Wormley was young. I helped Wormley grow and succeed.
I think what I see most companies where I see most companies succeed is when they start measuring their success by the impact they help customers make, which attracts customers because it's being talked about at the end, but it also attracts the right type of employees that are willing to put everything in there to make it happen. And of course, you have to break things and correct things and make it there. But I think you're right. That word momentum is a critical one. Now, it started with tender for co-founders. Then you had six pivots, so that's all the way forward, and now you're in this momentum loop. Maybe explain a little bit what Warmly really is now.
Totally. Skipping right to the end. Wormly is basically a tool that helps you grow your pipeline through automation and AI. And so what that means is we essentially try to find your entire total addressable market, all the companies you could sell to. We'll stack rank them based on the ones that you're most likely to close, and then we automatically help you reach out to all of those companies at scale to be able to more quickly generate meetings. And this will generally help you kind of create pipeline, almost an autopilot.
Well, on your website it says win with warm leads, not cold leads. So what is the secret there?
So one of the main things that I think people get wrong is they reach out to prospects that are never going to convert. And this is the problem, I guess, because basically, you are spending a lot of time and effort on things that are wasted activity. But if you use warm leads, where warm leads are basically leads that have exhibited some sort of intent signal that indicates that they might be ready to buy. And there are three kinds of intent signals: first party, second party, and third party. But without getting into the details, one example would be if a prospect comes to your website and they're searching around and looking on the pricing page, and then they leave. If you knew who that company was, or even the person who visited your site but hasn't converted yet, you could then retarget them with ads or emails or calls to continue to warm them up. And that will be much more higher converting than if you were to just reach out to any cold leads.
Yeah, I like your approach. That's also why I invited you because, I mean, honestly, this whole word at scale has always sort of given me the shivers because normally at scale means, okay, we're doing something. And if it doesn't work, we just do more of it, but something will stick. And what you're doing is exactly the opposite. You go from the intent perspective, and with the intent that you're seeing, that's how things are moving. And I think that is the way forward. Because otherwise, it's just going to be more noise and more noise and more noise. And I mean, I recently had Mark Kosoglow on the call, who is openly talking about the great ignore, which is getting realer and realer every single day.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, I think basically buyers just don't check their email anymore or reply to anybody who isn't someone they get a warm introduction to. And so if you have to break through the noise somehow, you have to do a really good job of brand marketing to kind of share who you are and what you do, but then also hit them at the right time in the right place across the right channel. And that's why with Warmly, you can do an omni-channel approach. So you can reach out to these signaled leads across email, chat, phone call, LinkedIn, wherever you might want to reach them.
Yeah, exactly. It ties back to something that I read about you. I'm not sure where I read it, but one of the things that were being said about you, very customer-centric focus, the emphasize that understanding customer needs is about long-term relationship. And I think that's all sort of embedded here. You know, the warm leads, the companies building a relationship with them over a longer time. How does Warmly support that?
Sorry, we said again, how does Warmly support what?
Well, building long-term relationship with customers, or is it more your own understanding or your own perspective on how do you build Warmly?
Both for sure. But the main point is that if you don't annoy the prospect in the buying process, then they're going to be more trusting of you in the long run. I've definitely had customers, even of ours, that have said, you use too many salespeople too many times. Everyone's hounding me, trying to get me to sign, trying to get me in by the end of the month and all that kind of stuff. And we kind of think that's sort of a outdated way of doing sales. I think if you build the relationship, then it goes a long way. But I totally understand that people have to, hit their goals. They have to kind of nudge people along. Sales is a tough process. And so it's not easy to be a salesperson, but you need to be able to lead with empathy and humanness to be able to drive a good sales cycle.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, empathy is super important. Moreover, also to get to really understanding the context of the problem that the other side is trying to solve. Talking about your point about your internal people kind of defining the problem, but it's equally important on the other side as well. Now, six pivots. We don't have to go through all of them, but what was the point where you said, okay, enough is enough, pivot?
I'm happy to go through each one and kind of where we thought each one would kind of land. I think the my general mental model for founders when you think about pivots, or really any early stage team, is go through a period of openness and a period of closeness. An open period is where you're exploring any kind of different idea and you're saying, we don't think the thing that we're doing now is going to work for X, Y, and Z reason. We're going to try a lot of different ideas. Then you find something you're excited about and you have to enter into a close period. And this is the part that most people get wrong. What they do is they say, okay, we're going to try this new idea, but we're not going to get rid of the old idea. We kind of miss it. We're going to do that a little bit. We're going to do this thing too. And then you kind of just like spread your focus. And so I'm a big believer in whatever you decide to focus on, focus deeply on it for a certain period of time. So when you're in your close period, you'll say, all right, for 3 months, we're going to pretend like this is the only idea we can ever do and we won't do anything else. And come hell or high water, we're just going to crush it. And for 3 straight months, you just focus and focus, focus, focus. And anytime you have a new idea for something new you might pivot to, you just write it down on a piece of paper that says, okay, this is my open ideas when I'm back to the open period. And then after 3 months, when you really, really focused, you open up again and you say, did those 3 months, how'd they go? Were they good? Should we look at the ideas, the open ideas we've had? Should we try something different? And then each time you iterate, your close period should be longer. So maybe your first close period is a month, then 3 months, then 6 months, then a year. And eventually, I think that's the right way to iterate yourself to success.
Let me make a small interruption here. Max just made an excellent remark that sets his entrepreneurial approach apart from standard startup advice. Go through a period of openness and a period of closeness. What most people get wrong is they say, we're going to try this new idea, but we're not going to get rid of the old idea. What happens then is that you start to spread your focus instead of the opposite. Max discipline not only leads to better execution, but prevents the death by a thousand cuts that kills so many promising startups. It's a trait remarkable software companies master. They acknowledge that they cannot please everybody. They master the art of curiosity, and they focus on the essence. And you can master these traits as well. The first step? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
That's kind of like my framework on how to pivot, but I'm also happy to go into the details of like how we pivoted each time.
Well, yeah, I mean, let's start with the first one, and then maybe a question on like what was the most impactful one sort of halfway, because I got other questions to ask as well. But let's start with the first one. You know, that we're still tender for co-founders.
Yeah, so I think the second half of 2019, we built Tinder for co-founders. This was sort of a swipey app where you could find a match. And really, it was something that we basically built something that nobody wanted and nobody would pay for. So, bad idea. In early 2020, the first half of the year, we built something that some people wanted, but nobody would pay for. And this was called push-pull cards. These were digital business cards that you could essentially list things that you could offer people. We called those pushes. And list things you needed. We called those pulls, and we would match you. It's kind of like a digital business card product. Again, something some people wanted, but no one would pay for. Then in the second half of the year, we pivoted again, where we did a lot of customer research. And this was kind of our first push into the real sales market, where I built something that budget holders wanted and would pay for, but we couldn't scale it. And this was called Track Advocates. And basically, we would monitor your CRM for when your existing customers change jobs and go to new companies so you can sell them again. The problem is we had to scrape LinkedIn to be able to do it, and we couldn't scale that. So it didn't work. Then in 2021, and this is, I think, probably our most impactful pivot, is we built something everybody wanted, but nobody would pay for. And this was our name tags product. And so as you see on my screen, if you're watching the visual of this, I have a name tag hovering in Zoom. And we were the first ever app on the Zoom App Store when COVID hit. And we thought, oh, everyone's on Zoom all the time. This is going to be great. We're going to build our digital business cards for salespeople on Zoom. And it was great. But if I asked you to pay $20 a month, nobody would pay for it. And so I think we focused on this for maybe 2 years, and we evolved it to enterprise teams, and we got some revenue on it, et cetera. But the truth is, it just didn't build a huge business. And then we pivoted from there into the Warmly we have today.
That's still quite a big shift from what I've just heard what Warmly is really all about versus the little things in between.
Kind of. I mean, the truth is, like, we learned a lot along the way. So we learned about how to work with salespeople, how to find signals, how to do virtual sales calls, about sales cycles. So we actually took a little bit of everything that we learned, including how to sell. So we struggled to sell these products, and then we learned to essentially be able to sell well using our own product. So we built a product to solve our own problem, and that was a huge learning for us. And then finally, it became something that budget holders would pay for, it scales, and it has the ability to be a category-defining product. And that, I think, meant a lot to us.
Okay. Category defining. For a lot of companies, it's always okay. I want to have a category defining product, but then when they hear about the education that needs to go in and the effort for people to get people to think differently, to even realize they have a problem, how did you go about that? Wasn't it going to be way easier to just find a, well, position yourself in an existing category, but in a completely unique way?
Definitely not. So the kind of core piece of a lot of our branding is what's called the Purple Cow philosophy. So there's a great guy, his name is Seth Godin,
Seth
who wrote the
Godin.
marketing book, The Purple Cow. Yeah, you know it. And he's awesome. And his thesis is basically that if you're in a field that is crowded, let's say 100 cows, and you want to be different than every other cow, what do you got to do? Paint yourself purple. And then all of a sudden, when the farmer goes around, he's not choosing between one in 100 cows, he's picking between one of two cows, either the purple one or the not purple one. And so I think it's way better to be number one in a category that you create than number four in a category that you don't create. And
True.
so that's why we kind of invented the category of signal-based sales, or signal-based orchestration. And we've been kind of a leader in the space ever since.
Fascinating. Love that. Yeah, I can see how, well, now that you connect the dots, I can see how this came about. What has been the hardest nut to crack in that last point from say pivot four all the way to where you are right now?
Well, everything we do for the first time. So I think, like, anything scaling beyond 300K of ARR has been really hard. Growing the team, everything breaks at every level of scale. So at our first million in ARR, everything broke. Now we're at 3.2 million in ARR, and everything's breaking again. And so to be able to scale requires breaking down the mold of what's worked in the past and then growing from there. So all those things have been super hard, but maybe if I could pick just one thing, it's probably learning how to do marketing, which is kind of funny because we sell to marketers now, but I just never really built a marketing organization before. We didn't need to build marketing because we didn't know marketing, And now we've built a really successful sales team, a really successful customer success team, a really successful product and engineering team. But we're early on in our marketing journey. And you know, the marketing team is the smallest department at the company. And so we have to figure out how to grow that.
So it's first being sales led, trying and getting a lot of no's, and eventually getting towards your 3.2 million ARR with the team you have today. So that's a great accomplishment. What I have actually seen and noticed also on LinkedIn is that one of the things that you talked about learning in the beginning, but you're not only learning, but also you're sharing. You know, you got your clear 100 initiative or clear 100% initiative. Tell me about that. Why did you start doing that?
So about a year ago, I decided to devote myself to helping the marketing team generate more pipeline through LinkedIn. So I do that with these organic social kind of posts. But I also wanted to kind of just like learn from marketing and salespeople who hang out on LinkedIn. And so I decided to hold myself accountable by sharing. And it was interesting because for maybe 5 years, every month of the company, I've written an update that I've shared to our investors and community. And our community was a growing mailing list of almost 1,000 people. And so I said, wait a minute, why am I sending this to 1,000 people on email when I could just send it to everybody on LinkedIn and see what the reaction is? And I guess I kind of thought that it's really hard to build a big company. And so you want to basically try to get as many supporters as you can to build that company. And what better way than to build in public and kind of do it in front of everyone? So that's why I post clear, which means I try to be transparent on what I'm learning and how I'm growing and what I'm fucking up on and how I'm changing things. And we're figuring out as we go. But I think I just want the people who are public or customers to see me as an earnest, honest founder who doesn't have all the answers, but just wants to be successful and hopes for the best that I can get there.
And I completely agree. It does really that. Everybody, if you haven't read it yet, just start following Max or Maximus, because these posts are truly fascinating. One of the ones that I think I responded to that with wow, something like that, was your Clear Day 393, talking about the learnings again and building marketing and building sales, learning from sales. You fired 11% of your customers, I think, beginning of January or so. So you fired customers, and it clearly had a purpose. And I think it set a big signal, well, first of all, internally about who you're for, who you're not for, but also to you, of course, to your customers about, that you want the best type of results for them. Was there anything else that was motivating you to fire those 11%? Because it's a lot.
I mean the post kind of covers a lot of it, but the high level points are basically that in the early days we brought on any customer who wanted to pay us money because who doesn't want more money? But what we weren't really thinking about is as we grow the platform and product, who are the customers that are going to get value long term? And I don't want to take someone's money if they're not going to be a good fit for us as a customer. So we decided to basically let those customers go and say, listen, like you're not getting a lot of value. We're not getting a lot of value out of you. We don't think you're getting a lot of value out of this platform. Let us refer you to our competitors and you can go get take, you know, give them their money. All good. But yeah, we kind of just figured out which customers work well for us. And we're moving up market as well. So we're working with larger customers and we're finding that we can deliver them a ton of value and they are happy with the product and don't take up a lot of time. And so there may be like five or six different reasons why we chose to fire a particular customer, but hopefully it's a one-time thing where we just sort of like kind of have a clean break, start the year off right, and really be able to grow in a clean way going forward.
I've seen other people in my sphere do the same thing, and it always turned out to be the best thing they've ever done until that point. So it's a really good thing. It's chapter one of my book. You acknowledge you cannot please everybody, and that's fine. I mean, and you're not a product-led growth company whereby you need thousands of customers per year. You said you've got 300 customers. You need 50, 60 per year. Let that be the best ones.
Well said.
Everybody happy. Yeah, exactly. So talking about that, what have you seen as the big challenge you had to overcome in order to get the traction with Warmly?
Well, I think that what's been cool to see is that you can get linear traction by just adding more salespeople. Like once you have product market fit, you figure out your sales motion. Every salesperson you add, you can maybe you give them an SDR to be successful generating top of funnel, but you can go do 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 and go linear growth in terms of getting kind of new sales. The really tricky thing is generating exponential growth. And one of the sort of classic VC expectations that you grow 10% per month. 10% per month is not linear growth. Even though the number 10 stays the same, it grows bigger and bigger because growing at 10% with 100K of ARR is 10K. Growing 10% at 10 million of ARR is a million. So you're basically needing to kind of really increase exponential growth. And the only way to do that is to unlock marketing and be able to generate inbound using various channel techniques. And so it's been kind of fascinating for me to watch as we've iterated on trying to generate and unlock exponential growth through marketing efforts, because we're sort of scaling well on the sales side, but we really want to juice inbound, which will come from good marketing.
Yeah. Yeah, you're completely right. There's so many things to that as well. But obviously, I imagine that you're using your own product.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's like now like 45% of our own revenue comes from our own product, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's a testimony to a product that works. But talking about scaling your sales team, have you seen in with that exercise and getting more and more focused that the productivity of your individual sales has also increased in terms of win rates, in terms of average deal value, in terms of lowering the number of days to get to the sale?
Yes and no. So every new salesperson you add decreases sales productivity for the whole team because you have less focus and attention on training, as well as you have less leads to split between them. And so they have to go chase more of their own deals, which takes time. So it's like generally a decrease in productivity. Okay. So every new salesperson decreases overall productivity a little bit. Then as you learn and you create programmatic, you know, kind of programs and trainings and videos to watch, et cetera, you raise that up. But as time goes on, you're separately focused on how you can do what you mentioned, which is improve win rates, increase ACV, shorten time to close for sales cycles. So those are just ongoing separate projects. I call them almost independent of hiring salespeople, but they sort of happen along the same timeline. And you at least have to offset the decrease in productivity that you lost when you hired a salesperson. But hopefully your experiments yield increase in all those metrics overall as you go forward.
Correct. You get a fair point about adding more salespeople decreases. But as, like you say, I mean, as you learn, it's also about making sure that the other things compensate for that.
I'll call out that a lot of early stage founders and sales leaders like don't follow the three most important sales metrics to track, which is close one rate, time to close, and ACV. So those three things you mentioned, super important to track and put up on a big dashboard and look at every single day and ask yourself, how can we increase these?
Yeah, exactly. So looking at your whole journey now, since 2019, 6 years down the road, six pivots, what is the most counterintuitive lesson that you've learned about scaling your company?
The co-founders should talk every single day. I think with scale, you could appreciate that, we'll talk weekly, we'll talk monthly, we'll do our own orgs. But if I'm not going back and forth 7 days a week, 365 days a year with my co-founders, we're not moving the chains in the business. And I think that probably before 100 million in ARR, I expect to talk to my co-founders every single day.
And at what moment did you find out that that helped?
Just trial and error. As soon as we stop talking regularly, everything breaks. Whenever we're in sync every single day, things go great. So it's like just a gut feeling.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like almost like a stand-up, right? They do stand-up with the team. You still do stand-up with your team. And that's that thing.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. Well, talking about, making sure that everything keeps going and that nothing breaks. What is a metric that you stopped tracking that you initially thought it was crucial?
Ooh, that's a great one. It's very easy. It's product market fit score. So Rahul Vora at Superhuman created this idea, which was a pretty good one, but it was basically only good for premium like PLG products. But I was very stupid and didn't realize that. But essentially, the idea was to query your users and ask them, if this thing went away tomorrow on a scale of 1 to 10, how upset would you be? And if your score was greater than an 8.5 or maybe it was like 8 on a regular basis, then you had product market fit. Mm-hmm. And I think that most startups just kind of like blanket applied that, but I found it to be an excuse for lack of sales. And basically the real metric that matters is whether you have dollars in your hand. And so it was a red herring. We focused on that for maybe like 6 to 9 months, and then we're eventually shaken loose by VCs being like, what the hell? You guys got to make money eventually. You can't just have like happy users. And the truth is the happy users were happy, but the people who put down the credit card weren't our users. And so when you have a different decision maker than you do end user, you realize that like you should be making the decision makers happy through building a product that you can convince them adds real tangible ROI.
I completely agree with that one. Yeah, I mean, it's so easy to just say, okay, well, it's the whole this software as a service world, but you got these two motions, PLG and sales led, they are so different, particularly because of the, yeah, what's at stake for a company.
That's right.
I mean,
That's right.
if you're invested with your credit card on something that costs $10 a month, or $1,000, or $10,000, or $100,000 a month, different beast.
Totally.
Regardless of whether you got fantastically happy users, it helps, of course, but nothing beyond that. You talked about learning. What is a skill or an area of knowledge that you're currently trying to kind of up in order to stay ahead of the game?
I'm trying to understand a lot more about how CMOs think in a mid-market companies. As we move up market, I want to, basically be able to appeal to marketing leadership. And I've never been a CMO at a mid-market company, so I need to lean on my advisors for help in understanding what are CMOs' biggest problems and like how are they hiring to solve those things using AI as well.
Yeah, exactly. Are there any specific things that you're doing on a day-to-day basis? People that you talk to?
It's just jumping on customer calls. Yeah, talking to prospects, talking to customers, asking their marketing teams how they're functioning, what they're doing, and then reading as well. I mean, on LinkedIn, newsletters, that kind of stuff. So it's a gradual thing. This one's a more complex skill. There are like more tactical skills that, you have to learn like, oh, like how do you create a financial model? How do you create a board deck? Like these things you can pick up in like a day. You just sort of like Google search some templates and like try it yourself and get some feedback from two VCs. But this skill of like deeply understanding your core persona as you change market segments is a whole new beast.
Exactly. That's very well articulated. I mean, talk to customers, and yeah, I mean, you can try to kind of search everything online, but it's all about the context that they are in with your products,
Yep.
and where they try to go themselves. So yeah, the only way to learn about it is to talk to the people themselves, your listening tour. Talking about, well, you said I talk to my co-founders every single day. Of course, these people come with ideas. You come with ideas. You want to move the company forward in a specific direction. Do you have any framework with regards to how do you deal with conflicting priorities? I saw that you're a big fan of rather making 10 decisions fast and get one wrong rather than 10 decisions slow and get them all right. But maybe this is sort of in between.
I guess the main job as a CEO is to delegate decision making to people you trust. And so building trust with your leadership team is important. I think that you can, express your opinion on how an idea should function or operate or a solution that should be used. But like my job is to set the priorities and the vision and then to let my leaders define the problems they're hoping to solve and if they solve them, which metrics it'll move. And so I think that I just try to ask people to explain to me how the metric's going to move. And like one of my favorite lines is, tell me a story that starts with your idea and ends with us making more money and make that story as short as possible. And if there's like seven hoops you have to jump through before you make more money, then it's a bad idea. If there's three hoops you jump through before you make more money, then that's a good idea. And so that's, I guess, the coaching that I would give to the team on like which decisions they should go for. But I've learned over time as I kind of transition from founder to CEO, that I leave the like which ideas were chosen to the team because it makes the team excited. I mean, it's fun for the team to be able to choose their ideas and chase them down, and I'm just there to help them execute on them.
Exactly. Yeah. It's servant leadership. It's about giving people autonomy. That's why they want to work for you. You know, they feel they can make a difference. Yeah. Well, no, this is
Yeah,
why
I
they
think
work
so.
for you, work for the company, and want to stay there. And like you said before, you normally had meetings in order to prevent people from going. This is the opposite. And I've heard it on so many of these podcast calls over the last couple of years. Fantastic way to achieve that. Last question. From all the lessons that you've learned right now, and by the way, I like that lesson about the storytelling and the three hoops. But beyond that, if there's from all the lessons that you learned and the tidbits of wisdom that you gained, what would be a do and what would be a don't that you'd like to share with peer tech entrepreneurs?
I would say do treat your co-founders to a nice dinner every 6 months or so, and celebrate the journey and ride you've been on, and really reminisce about everything you've learned and how it hasn't been easy, but you keep going along the way. And I think that's just so easily forgotten, is that like you're on a learning journey to understand yourself, and you're doing it through the medium of company creation. And like the goal, of course, is to build a big business, but why do you want to build a big business as a human being? It's to like make yourself, have a great life, be, independent, be able to drive some sense of meaning out of this weird existence that is on this planet. And so I think having a nice dinner every once in a while is nice, just reminiscing. The don't, I would say don't do the things that make you comfortable because you'll fail if you do. And oftentimes when things aren't going well in the company, you feel like you want to make progress. And so you look at your skill set and you're like, well, I'm really good at coding, so let me just go code some more features and maybe that'll fix everything. But that never does, right? If you're coding and things aren't going well, it's probably because your sales suck and you're not addressing why your sales suck because you're like too busy coding. And so I think there's this kind of this like spiraled loop where when things go bad, you go focus on the things that you're good at because it feels like progress is being made. And so you need to constantly check yourself and ask yourself, what's really going wrong? And what can I do today that's going to make me really uncomfortable? What am I avoiding because I don't want to address the hard fucking truth that this thing is fundamentally broken and I may need to pivot.
Yeah, exactly. It goes back to the question of curiosity again, or the trait of curiosity, daring to ask those tough questions, first of all, and figuring out what is really going on. Yeah. Which also makes sense if you speak to your co-founders every single day. Doesn't come by surprise then. Well, this was, well, I mean, I could talk for another couple of hours here. It was super insightful, very interesting to understand the journey that you're on with Warmly. Where can people go to find out more about Warmly? Or to say hi to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for asking. So I would certainly love to offer people who listen to the podcast free leads. If you go to warmly.ai, you can increase your pipeline by getting 500 personal identified leads on your website every month delivered right to you in Slack. And so please come check out our free tier at warmly.ai. And then if you want to follow my Going Clear series, where I'm just kind of posting about everything that I'm learning as an early stage founder growing in the marketing and sales tech world, you can find me on LinkedIn at Maximus Greenwald.
Good. Well, thank you very much. I'll keep following you on the journey. Maybe we do another podcast in about 3 years' time to see where
Great.
you are back then. But for now, enjoy Chamonix, close to seven. So not good time for skiing, but likely tomorrow.
Thank you so much for the time. Bye, Dan.
Bye-bye. And this ends my conversation with Max, and I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspires you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Maximus Greenwald, CEO of Warmly. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.